This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, a sort of biography, written and read by Eric Idle.
An apology. Graham Chapman once said, life is rather like a yacht in the Caribbean. It's all right if you've got one. Well, I've been travelling at the speed of life for 75 years now, and I still don't have one. But then again, I wrote, Life's a Piece of Shit, When You Look at It, while reminding everyone to look on the bright side. A line that I discovered recently is as old as Coleridge. This book is partly the story of that song, and partly the story of a boy who became me. If you like, the memoirs of a failed pessimist. I still remain foolishly optimistic, even with the threat of global warming, which worries me slightly less than personal cooling. And so I've written my recollections before I forget everything and develop amnesia, which is what you get from being an old actor. Of course, I have faults, but you won't read about them here. I've glossed over all my shortcomings. That is, after all, the point of autobiography. It is the case for the defence. But I will own up to not being perfect. I have British teeth. They are like British politics. They go in all directions at once. Writing about yourself is an odd mix of therapy and lap dancing. Exciting, and yet a little shameful. So here is my own pathetic addition to the celebrity memoir. On the advice of my lawyer, I'm leaving out the shameful bits, and on the advice of my wife, the filthy bits. But as usual in my career, I will leave you wanting less. If this isn't exactly what went down, it's certainly how it should have happened. Look at the bright side always. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Chapter 1. Crucifixion. It's October 1978, and I'm being crucified. I'm 30 feet up on a cross in Tunisia singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Beneath me, in a troglodyte courtyard, dug out another 40 feet below ground level, an Arab woman sweeps her front yard. She never looks up. We've been here for 3 days. It's the final scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, and the song I wrote echoes across the desert to the distant hills. John Cleese has the flu. The rest of the Pythons seem fairly cheery. There are 23 of us on crosses and only 3 ladders, so between takes, if you need a pee, there is a desperate wait. I suppose if that's the only moan you have about being crucified, you are on the whole lucky. There's something a little chilling about turning up for work and finding a cross with your name on it. Oh, sure, they weren't using nails, and we had bicycle seats to perch on, but it makes you think, hanging up there for 3 days in your underpants, gazing out at the desert. Perhaps everyone should be crucified for a few days, because it does give you a good perspective on life, especially if you're singing a song that references your own passing. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And don't think the irony escaped me. I've always known this last little giggle at my expense lies somewhere in the future. I only hope there's a good turnout. The song was supposed to be ironic, but it ended up being iconic. I mean, you can't have much less of a future to be bright about than when being crucified. But people began to sing it in real wars and in real danger. It struck a chord somehow, and now people sing it everywhere, including football matches and funerals. Especially funerals. As of this writing, it's the number one song requested at British funerals. So here I am, up on a cross in Tunisia, singing it for the first time to Graham Chapman. How the hell did I get here? Chapter 2, A Scar is Born. By an odd coincidence, I was born on my birthday, in the same place as my mother, Harton Hospital, South Shields, County Durham, though luckily not at the same time. I was born plain Eric Idle. We couldn't afford a second name. There was a war on. At the time of my birth, Hitler was trying to kill me. Nothing personal. But fortunately, he missed. The closest he got is one of my earliest memories, a shot-up U.S. Wellington bomber limping home from Germany, crashing in flames in the field beside my nursery school. Nothing to worry about, said the nurses as they hustled us inside. Surely the scariest words you can ever hear. Then I learned the truth from my mum. The American pilot was looking for an emergency landing in the field. He saw the kids playing and deliberately turned away, taking the plane down. I've always liked Americans. They're brave buggers. So close, Adolf, but no cigar. If one of the best ways to appreciate life is to have an unhappy childhood, I was very fortunate. Things began badly and got worse. Try this for irony. My father was killed hitchhiking home from World War II. He'd been in the RAF since 1941 in the most dangerous seat of a Wellington bomber, that of the rear gunner wireless operator, from which he emerged unscathed. And yet, 7 months after the war in Europe was over, he was killed in a road accident hitchhiking home for Christmas. All over England, servicemen were waiting to be demobbed. And as the trains were full for the holidays, they were told to thumb for rides, since everyone stopped for the boys in uniform. My dad got a lift in the back of a lorry load of steel. Just outside Darlington, a car swerved to avoid oncoming traffic. The truck veered off the road, the load of steel shifted and crushed him. He died in hospital on Christmas Eve, my mother by his bedside. I was almost three. You can see how Christmas was never much fun in our household. I wonder if that's why I wrote the song Fuck Christmas. After I was born, my father was rarely home. Wars are like that. The Air Force maps they used had code words on them. I found the words spam exit in my dad's tidy handwriting. I also found a few references to myself in his tiny RAF diary for 1945. The choking words for July the 7th. Eric's first paddle and trip to the beach. My father's grave is in an RAF cemetery. They're drawn up in neat lined slabs, forever at attention. Name, rank, serial number, and date of death. December 24, 1945. Above, the Latin words of the RAF motto, Per ardua ad astra. Through hard work, to the stars. It could be the watchword for mankind entering the space age, or a young man entering show business. My mother disappeared for a while into depression, and I was brought up by my gran in Swinton, Lancashire. Her husband, a dentist, who I call Pop, took me to the Bellevue Circus in Manchester, where, amazingly, it turned out we were circus royalty. My great-grandfather was Henry Bertrand, a famous ringmaster and circus manager in the 1880s. I still have his notepaper with his imposing picture in white tie and tails, announcing he is the advance manager of Robey's Midget Minstrels. Only afterward did I realise that I too ended up in a circus, and a flying one at that. When I did a little research into him recently, I found out that, incredibly, he'd begun life as a comedian. Isn't that slightly too much coincidence? In my novel, The Road to Mars, I postulated that this was evidence of a comedy gene. I was joking, but now I'm not so sure. Anyway, as a child, it was exciting to be taken backstage at Bellevue Circus to meet the terrifying clowns, who were very respectful to Pop as a Bertrand and extremely friendly to me. Pop also took me to see various variety shows at the Manchester Hippodrome, where I saw the best of British music hall comedians, Morecambe and Wise, Rob Wilton, Jimmy Edwards, Arthur Askey, Norman Evans, Mrs. Shufflewick, Norman Wisdom, and the Crazy Gang. The most memorable thing about the variety shows were the tableaux vivants, where a stage full of beautiful girls stood or sat stark naked. This was the first time I ever saw a nude woman, and suddenly there were 24 of them. It was called A Scene from Winter, and fake snow fell while they posed with nothing on but discreetly placed drapery. The orchestra played and someone recited a daft little poem while the girls just sat there. They weren't allowed to move. In those days, it was illegal to move around on stage naked. If they did, they could be arrested. But as long as they didn't move, it was all right, and everyone applauded. I remember thinking, this is great! And ever since then, I've always been very fond of nude ladies. So that's my background in show business. Circuses, clowns, comedians, and nude ladies. In 1948, when I was five, my gran took me to see three films in one day. I'd never seen a movie before, and I was hooked right away. We saw Joan of Arc, The Glass Mountain, and a Marx Brothers movie, one after the other. 24 nude ladies all at once, and then 3 movies in a day. Can you see the way my life's going? We were a pre-television generation and grew up with radio, listening to gripping series like Journey into Space and Dick Barton's Special Agent, and hilarious comedians like Al Reed. Can you smell gas, or is it me? There was also the incomparable Goon Show, a popular BBC radio comedy with Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Harry Secombe. The first time I ever saw TV was the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. My school brought in a tiny 8-inch black and white screen, and we sat around watching people walking up and down singing, "Why That Regina," in funny costumes. They gave us lots of coronation toys, mugs, golden coaches and paper crowns, and that morning on the radio the BBC announced we'd conquered Everest. Well, a New Zealander and a Tibetan Sherpa conquered Everest, but it was a British expedition. When I was 5, my mother, now working as a nurse in Cheshire, sent me to school for the first time to St. George's Wallasey, a small seaside town just a ferry ride across the River Mersey from Liverpool. One day I was missing from home. I met a boy called George playing on the Red Noses, the sand dunes at New Brighton. This was a very popular outing from Liverpool, and we were always playing with kids from the other side of the Mersey. George and I played happily all day, losing all sense of time. Many years later, when I met George Harrison and we became close friends, I had a very strong feeling that we'd met before, and I often wondered if he was the boy who bunked off with me that day. I guess I'll never know, but when I finally got home, my mother was freaked out. It was difficult for her to cope with a growing son and a full-time job, and my disappearing like that scared her. So she accepted an offer from the RAF Benevolent Fund and put me at the age of 7 into the Royal School Wolverhampton, which had just changed its name from the Royal Orphanage. The war had given this Victorian institution a shot in the arm, but there is no escaping the pull of irony. I was sent to a school paid for by the RAF to grow up with boys, all of whom had lost their fathers in the war. We called it the OFNI, short for Orphanage. My first night at school, I found myself in a dormitory with a lot of crying boys. I decided not to join them. What was the point? Earlier that day, when my mother dumped me there, she simply left and disappeared. She didn't say goodbye, she just took off. Later on, she said, "Well, I didn't want to cause a fuss. You were happily playing, so I thought I'll just slip away and avoid a scene." Very northern mother, that. Above all else, avoid a scene. I still have nightmares when I'm back at the OFNI. It was very grim at the time and is terrifying in retrospect. I was there from 7 years old until I managed to escape at the age of 19. It was a physically abusive, bullying, harsh environment for a kid. The terms were an interminable 14 weeks. At the age of 7, they seemed everlasting. 12 years, you get less for murder. In the junior school, Miss McCartney whacked me across the hand with a wooden ruler because I didn't understand a math problem. Surprisingly, I remained bad at math. At the age of 11, I nervously entered the senior school. Bullying was endemic. The prefects were allowed to whack you with slippers. The masters could beat you with canes. For severe crimes, like giggling in prep, you could be sent to the headmaster for 6 of the best. I was once sent for a beating for silent insolence. Not even saying anything. I mean, what chance does that give you? The senior school had a dormitory 100 yards long, and at night the prefects would patrol up and down. If they heard someone talking after lights out and nobody owned up, everybody had to get out of bed and bend over their beds while they went down the line and whacked the whole dorm. And it was freezing. I was cold until I was 19. No wonder I moved to California. But unhappiness is never forever. There were moments of happiness, sardonic laughter at how, while you were being beaten, they would say, "It's for your own good." "Oh, well, why don't I do it for you then?" I was fairly funny at school, and humour is a good defence against bullying. It's hard to hit a smaller boy when you're laughing. I got used to dealing with gangs of males and getting on with life in unpleasant circumstances, while being smart at the expense of authority. Perfect training for Python. I used to be very bitter about my school days, but now I think it was there I learned everything I needed to survive in life. It's a cruel joke to be called idle when shoved into an English boarding school, but it does prepare you to deal with insult, and I always had several good comebacks up my sleeve. Asked about the origins of my name on a British TV show, I speculated it was from Yorkshire and came from the idle mechanism on the woolen looms. When I got home, there was a message from George Harrison saying, "Come off it, you're just from a long line of lazy old bastards." I've since learned that the actual origin is from the English word idel, meaning unused ground or patch of waste. A patch of waste. I've been called worse. When I was 12, my gran gave me a small portable typewriter and I began writing stories. The Mystery of the Missing Skull, a Boadicea story, and endless war tales about heroic RAF men. I was always interested in words because in such a sterile environment you have to create your own entertainment and explore your own brain. Reading was, and still is, my great escape. I also like puppeteering with string marionettes, writing sketches and doing funny voices, hiding in character and poking fun at the masters. We were very subversive and got huge laughs. I performed in a school musical, Toad of Toad Hall, where I played second field mouse. I turned down the offer to play first field mouse, as I realised second field mouse had more words. Well, three more words. I became a folky in a trio, where I played harmonica with the Sinfield brothers on banjo and guitar. And we mainly did blues. It's always struck me as odd how we identified with the black struggle in the southern US when we were very white boys in an English boarding school thousands of miles away from the deep south. But their songs became our songs of protest too, and we sang away to Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. We were being repressed, and I guess the spirit of the music, the soul of it, was very close to what we felt. Then along came rock and roll. Elvis saved our lives. He seemed to be singing directly to us. At 14, I wanted to play guitar very badly. By 15, I did. Elvis was amazing. We adored him. I heard him first singing Heartbreak Hotel on every jukebox at Butlin's Holiday Camp in Skegness in the summer of 1957, while teddy boys snapped their fingers and girls jibed to that haunting voice. Back at school, we gathered excitedly round the telly to see if it was true what was in the papers, that the cameras wouldn't shoot him below the waist. He danced, he jived, he shook those hips, and we heard the screams of the girls, but nothing below the waterline was shown on television. Perhaps it was the trousers. Elvis was our hero throughout my school years, and we listened to him under the sheets, first on crystal sets we built ourselves, sending away for parts like cat's whiskers and tuning coils, and then finally on tiny transistor radios. Later, when Elvis was sent into the army, it cast a gloom over us all. It seemed they had won. They cut his hair and flew him off to Germany. Then Buddy Holly died. It was all too much. At the Offney, every Monday afternoon from the age of 11, we had to pretend we were in the army. Joining the CCF, the Combined Cadet Force, was compulsory. We're 11 years old and we're out on the playground in army boots, marching up and down the square in itchy uniforms, being yelled at by professional drill sergeants from the Walsall barracks. What the hell's this? I can still feel the webbing on the gaiters and smell the Blanco product with which we painted them khaki. Polishing boots and shining brasses was something we had to do not just for our own uniforms, but also for a designated senior boy, because in our first year we were all fags. In British boarding school speak, a fag is a first-year slave for a prefect, making him toast and cleaning his shoes and running his errands. If we were late, we were beaten. Character forming is, I think, the expression. By the age of 14, not only could I perform arms drill and shoot a 303 Lee Enfield rifle with reasonable accuracy, I could strip a Bren gun blindfolded. Then they'd drop us in the Welsh mountains in full gear and say, "See you." And 6 hours later, if you were lucky, you'd stagger into a military camp in North Wales, armed only with a compass and a bit of cheese. Very useful little things to know in life. And certainly it prepared me for Python movies. So yes, things were rough, but we fought back. We organised our own nightlife. There was a girls' school under the same roof. We'd see the girls in chapel, because church was compulsory twice on Sundays. But they would be on their side of the chancel, and we on ours. Of course, being teenagers with rampant hormones, we'd try to slip messages to them during the long and interminably boring psalms while God was being cruel to the children of Israel. As we said of the children of Israel, when will they ever grow up? I volunteered for the job of school postboy. Every afternoon I collect the official mail and take it down to the bright red pillar box on Penn Road. I'd exit through the back gate of the boys' school, turn left and walk 50 yards to the back gate of the girls' school, where there was always a crowd of young females hanging out. I exchanged pleasantries and clandestine billy-doo not intended for the public mailbox. They had cryptic acronyms on them. SWALK, sealed with a loving kiss. And BURMA, be undressed ready, my angel. On my return, there would be hastily scribbled responses. By being both helpful and flirtatious, I soon had a girlfriend of my own. In the long dorm, we slept in numerical order. They'd have made us shit in order if they could. My number was 63, and randomly, next to me, was 64. Hawes Jr., a wonderfully subversive chap, and luckily in my form. We became accustomed to slipping through the back gardens to the off-license to buy bottles of Mitchell's and Butler's Old English Stout and Caerphilly cheese. These we would consume after lights out in the comforting warmth of the metal stove in the scout hut, where the Boy Scouts met by day and we relaxed by night, smoking Balkan Sobrani in clay pipes or baby's bottom tobacco through long-stemmed rosewood churchwarden pipes. At this point, Hawes Jr. and I upped our game. We realised that while the girls' school was desperately out of bounds, it was terribly close, and there were no actual locked doors between the boys' and girls' schools. All we had to do was face the 50 yards of darkness, and suddenly we would be there. Fortunately, the cadet corps had taught us how to creep about silently in the dark, so we made a recce, and it all worked perfectly. No one was around in the early hours of the morning. Thus emboldened, we climbed the stairs up into the girls' dorm, made rendezvous with our respective amours, and led them back to the scout hut, where we enjoyed a bottle of sweet martini and some baby sham, a cheap pear champagne. These midnight encounters continued for some time, until eventually word got out and other boys began to take advantage of this exciting opportunity. Eventually, it was not uncommon to be woken at night by a girl asking where so-and-so's bed was. In the end, the clandestine nightlife of the school became so sophisticated that we stole and copied the key to the swimming pool, a reeky green steamy hellhole. And if you wanted to go swimming with the girls, all you had to do was to put your name down on a list after prep, and you would be woken and escorted by flashlight through the Byzantine corridors down to the pool, where a small group of girls in dressing gowns awaited. It's amazing we were never busted. The reason, of course, was that the prefects became involved and thereby utterly subverted. Hard to bust other boys when you have a sweet companion in your own bed. I'm not too sure how much all of this led to full intercourse. I think a lot of it was what was called heavy petting in those days. For despite all this opportunity, I managed to enter Cambridge a virgin. But unlike Isaac Newton, I did not leave it like that. I got very good at misbehaving and being sneaky and anti-authoritarian at the Offney. It was like a combination of the army and prison, where you learn to adapt and trust your peers. My form was a highly organised criminal group. We never took a straight exam until O-level at 16, because we'd always steal the exam papers. Some boys were very adept at picking locks, or they'd unscrew the backs of wardrobes where the teachers stored the tests, and then they'd write the answers overnight on stolen exam paper and smuggle those in under their jumpers and substitute them. It was only at O-level that I discovered I was comparatively clever, when most of the other boys in my class simply didn't return after the summer holidays. They'd all failed. That was the first straight exam they'd ever taken. I think only 8 of us returned. There were rumours that some were already in jail. We had very muddy playing fields, and I wasn't very good at football. So on a Thursday afternoon, instead of changing for compulsory games, I would put on my school cap and march out the front door and go downtown to Wolverhampton and watch a movie. I did this regularly, walking boldly past the headmaster's study, and nobody ever caught me, because if you've got your bright red school cap on and you're using the front door, you're clearly doing some school business, right? So I learned very early on that if you're brazen, nobody questions you. If I'd been sneaking out, I'd probably have been caught. Well, I finally was caught in my penultimate year. I was a senior prefect and taking prep when the headmaster sent for me, and he said, "Ah, Idle, did you enjoy the movie this afternoon?" "No, not very much, sir. It wasn't very good," I said, annoying him. I'd been spotted and reported for watching a racy film, Butterfield 8 with Elizabeth Taylor. So I was beaten, of course, six of the best, and next morning hauled up in front of the entire school and denounced by the headmaster for this dreadful crime. Idle had been caught downtown, going to an X-rated movie. Well, I couldn't give myself a better PR job. Suddenly I was a hero. The whole school loved me. I was publicly sent to the back of the hall, and I was no longer a prefect. Kids were slapping me on the back and giving me the thumbs up. It was brilliant. Then, at the end of the year, the headmaster left the school with the surprising recommendation that I be made head boy. Maybe he liked me. Maybe he liked Elizabeth Taylor. Maybe he just wanted to screw up his successor. In the first term of my final year, my wonderful ex-RAF history teacher, Mr. Fry, arranged for me to apply to his old Cambridge College, Pembroke. I took a Harry Potter steam train to the Fens and was interviewed to read English by an economist, the dean, and an Arab scholar. Amazingly, they offered me a place, if I could pass O-level Latin in a year. A doddle. Since I was now suddenly and weirdly head boy, the school insisted I must also be the head of the combined cadet force, which I didn't want to be. At the end of 6 years of military training, they had made the mistake of sending us off on a civil defence course, which showed precisely what happens when a nuclear bomb goes off, and as a result, I'd become violently pacifist. During the Easter holidays, 1962, I went on the Older Marston March, the annual CND anti-nuclear rally. We marched from Older Marston in Hampshire to Hyde Park, a distance of about 54 miles, behind banners singing protest songs, "We shall overcome." We didn't. Instead, we camped overnight in Reading and then marched proudly into London. My friend Alan Sinfield, a dark-haired, saturnine, poetry-reading guitarist from our folk trio, was by then at University College London, and we were very lefty and very committed, and it was great. When I got back to school, the new padre called me in and said, "You're a hypocrite, Idle. You're the head of the CCF, and you went on the Older Marston March." And I said, "Well, I resign." And he said, "You're not allowed to resign." So, at the Monday Army Parade, I would take the salute from the English master, turn the wrong way about to annoy the professional drill sergeants, and slope off and read. I refused to go to military camp in Wales at the end of the year. They couldn't throw me out because I'd left. I'd been accepted by Cambridge University. I was on the Older Marston March, and I didn't take any of their combined cadet force bollocks seriously. Then my entire life changed. What changed me forever was comedy. My epiphany began at Beyond the Fringe. In early 1963, I stayed with Alan Sinfield in North London, and we went to every single play we could. It was the time of the playwrights known as the Angry Young Men, so named after Look Back in Anger, John Osborne's groundbreaking play, which we saw at the Royal Court Theatre. For this new sold-out review at the Fortune Theatre, performed by four men from Oxbridge, we could only get standing room tickets, which was just as well because I would never have stayed in a seat. I rolled around screaming with laughter. I've never laughed so hard in my life. I had no idea you could be that funny, or that you could laugh at the Prime Minister and the Army and the war and the royal family. Everything I secretly hated was being mocked, and they were doing this so wittily. They were young, smart, and dangerously funny. This was anger, but it was being used for laughter. I immediately bought the record and learned everything. Alan Bennett's sermon, Peter Cook's Prime Minister speech, Jonathan Miller's whimsical monologues, and we would go and watch Dudley Moore playing jazz piano in Oxford Street. Beyond the Fringe was an amazing show. From that point on, I could not conceive of life without comedy. Chapter 3, Lucky Bastard. Emerging from 12 years underground as a chrysalis in Wolverhampton to 3 years as a butterfly in Cambridge, I was a lucky bastard. Didn't Napoleon say it is better to be lucky than funny? No, he didn't, did he? Still, I first began to perform comedy at Cambridge University almost by accident. It was certainly good fortune that I found myself in Pembroke College, for the great Peter Cook had recently been there, and people were still quoting him. Tragically, I was an only twin. I'd like to invent something really important, like fire. It was fairly extraordinary that a lower middle-class boy like me from a lowly Midlands charity school was accepted, but Cambridge was changing. My education was paid for by Warwickshire County Council, and my old school generously kicked in a decent scholarship, which meant I was better off than many of the public school boys who had to try to shake down their parents for cash. Packing for Cambridge, I'd included a condom I'd been optimistically carrying around in my wallet for 2 years. But in 1962, Cambridge was still a monastic society. There were no females in the all-male Pembroke. Women had their own colleges. I was still going over the wall to meet girls. In order to increase my chances, I joined the Pembroke Players. At their Christmas party, I wrote and performed a cabaret, which was greeted so well, I was told I should try out for the Pembroke Smoker, a three-night comedy review held in the old Reader underneath the Wren Library. I found myself auditioning for Timbrook Taylor and Bill Oddie. Isn't it odd that two future goodies, Tim and Bill, who would soon have their own BBC TV comedy series with Graham Garden, who would himself spend 2 years doing Cambridge Cabaret with me, should be casting a future Python? Odder still was that on my debut they gave me a piece to perform written by John Cleese. John wasn't at Pembroke, but he dined there every night. He couldn't appear in the College Smoker because he was not a member of the college, but I could, and he was there at my first ever public performance, watching me do a sketch he had written for himself. It was called BBC BC, about the biblical news. I played a weather forecaster. Down in the south, well, Egypt's had a pretty nasty spell of it recently. 17 or 18 days ago was frogs, followed by lice, flies, and last Tuesday, locusts. And now, moving in from the south-southeast, boils. Further outlook for Egypt, well, 2 or 3 days of thick darkness lying over the face of the whole land, followed by the death of all the firstborn. Sorry about that, Egypt. After the show, Humphrey Barclay, a highly talented Harrovian head boy who could act, direct and draw cartoons, introduced me to John Cleese, a very tall man with black hair and piercing dark eyes. They were very complimentary and encouraged me to audition for the Footlights. I'd never heard of this university review club, founded in 1883 to perform sketches and comedy shows, but it seemed like a fun thing to do. And a month later, Jonathan Lynn and I were voted in by the committee, after performing to a packed crowd of comedy buffs in the Footlights clubroom. Jonathan, a talented actor, writer and jazz drummer, would go on to direct Past the Butler, my first play in the West End, and also write and direct Nuns on the Run, a movie with me and Robbie Coltrane. The audition sketch I'd written for us played surprisingly well, and strange details. In the front row, lounging on a sofa, laughing with some senior fellows, was the author Kingsley Amis, next to the brother of the soon-to-be-infamous Guy Burgess, who would shortly flee the country, outed as perhaps the most flamboyant of all the Cambridge spies. For whenever he was outrageously drunk in Washington, which was every night, he would announce loudly to everybody that he was a KGB spy. Nobody believed him. I soon adapted to Footlights club life. We had our own bar, which opened at 10 at night and stayed open as long as we wanted. Lunches were provided on the premises, and twice a term there were smoking concerts, where you could try out material. I soon learned a very valuable lesson, for one day I picked up a headmaster sketch written by John and read it and didn't find it very amusing. That night he performed it and absolutely killed. He brought the place to a standstill. So much is how you do it. That was the most valuable thing about the Footlights, learning the art of writing and performing by watching and doing. That year's annual review, which ran for 2 weeks at the Cambridge Arts Theatre, was the funniest thing I'd seen since Beyond the Fringe. It was called A Clump of Plinths, a very cliché kind of title, and John stood out head and shoulders amongst a great cast. And like the others, he never let on that he was being funny. He was always deadly serious, the deadest of deadpans. I watched in sheer joy. The show toured the UK and was then picked up by producer Michael White and put into the West End under the title Cambridge Circus. By that time, a tall, gangly, pipe-smoking Graham Chapman had joined the cast. He had studied medicine at Cambridge and was now at St. Bart's Hospital, where he was learning to become a fully qualified alcoholic. He also became a doctor, something he frequently warned us about. Always remember, doctors are just ex-medical students. He was very funny and odd in a deeply serious way. Oh, and finally, the condom got used after a Pembroke Players party where a Belgian wardrobe mistress showed me how to wear it and kindly removed me of the burden of enforced chastity, showing me that so often show business is about sex. This was a double kindness, as I'd been fending off an aggressive marital attack from a determined Northern Teachers Training College lass, who grudgingly gave up bases, each base surrendered after more compromising promises on my part. Luckily, I realised her game was to have sex only after marriage, and she was planning to take me home to Blackpool to meet her mother. I fled overseas. The previous year, in the summer of 1962, just before going up to Cambridge, I had set off hitchhiking through France and Germany with my friend Alan Sinfield. We carried rucksacks and slept in sleeping bags in fields and half-built houses on building sites, heading optimistically for Vienna. We'd been having pretty good fortune with rides when, on the Autobahn entrance just outside Stuttgart, we were picked up by a young German couple in a black Mercedes.
Where are you heading?
Vienna. How about Munich? Wonderful. It was a great ride, though the man and his young apple-cheeked girlfriend didn't say very much. We stopped for lunch, and he generously paid for everything. You're heading for Vienna. Hey, why don't we stay overnight in Munich, and I'll take you on to Vienna tomorrow. Tonight we'll dine at the Hofbrauhaus. Sounds amazing. Gee, thanks. He checks us into a little pensione in Munich. 2 twin rooms for the night, one for him and his girl, one for us. Fabulous. I'm just going to gas the car, and then I'll take you to dinner, okay? Okay. Too busy believing in our own good fortune, we hadn't even brought the baggage out of the car yet. But his girlfriend was with us, so what could go wrong? He didn't return. 2 hours passed. Something was not right. Where the hell is he? We finally demanded of his girlfriend. She broke down in tears. She didn't know him. She wasn't his girlfriend. He'd picked her up in Pforzheim, just before Stuttgart, where he stopped to pick us up. What? Shit! So he'd gone, with our rucksacks and everything we owned in the world. Passports, traveller's checks, clothing, underwear, sleeping bags, the lot. Shit! 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 The girl was in tears. We had no money. We had to go to the local police with the weeping Fraulein. They took notes and shrugged. We must go to the British Embassy. But it was Friday evening. It wouldn't open again till Monday. What were we to do? They shrugged. Farewell to the nice pension. We had only the clothes on our backs. We slept rough for 3 nights in the parks and the Munich train station. Finally, on Monday morning, we were issued with temporary visas by the British Embassy and given a little cash to get home. We hitched back the way we came, telling our sad tale. The Germans who stopped were all embarrassed by what had happened to us. They went out of their way to be nice, paying for meals and even inviting us into their homes. Broke and baggageless, we slunk back to England. We never saw Vienna. Still, schau immer auf die Sonnenseite des Lebens. Always look on the bright side of life. Interestingly, we got our rucksacks back. Turns out the man was a North German criminal on the run from Hamburg, wanted by the police. We were probably good cover for him. Eventually, they caught him in Italy. Undeterred by our first experience, we decided to try hitchhiking to Germany again the following year. This time we set out a little more prepared. Alan had some relatives in Berlin who offered us a room. So we hitched as far as Nuremberg, where we stood on the reviewing stand at the National Parade Grounds, where Hitler had stood, and did our Charlie Chaplin impersonations. This was as far as we could go. The only way to get to Berlin was through communist East Germany. So we booked ourselves a bus ride. We should have wondered what was up when we were immediately pulled off the bus and roughly searched by the East German border guards, who interrogated us as to the point of our visit. Two English boys with nothing very much on them? Why were they so interested? We'd seen no newspapers in 3 weeks. We found ourselves the only people in Germany totally ignorant of the fact that US President John F. Kennedy was paying a state visit to Berlin the very next day at the height of the Cold War. We were inadvertently at the centre of the world. Alan's relatives greeted us warmly, and we even had beds. Next day, we lined the streets with thousands of Berliners to watch the cavalcade go by. 16 limos of Secret Service, followed by 17 limos of press. Finally they appeared. Konrad Adenauer, the West German Chancellor, and Willy Brandt, the legendary mayor of West Berlin, standing up in the back of an open vehicle, flanking the smiling JFK. I remember the shock of his hair, and how surprised I was by his very ruddy appearance. The Germans went nuts. We went home and watched the famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech live on TV. Within an hour, flyers and cards and posters with this slogan appeared on the streets. Turns out he had less than 4 months to live. The next day, East German leader Walter Ulbricht visited East Berlin, and the day after that, tensions were high as we slipped through Checkpoint Charlie on a closely guarded tour bus to visit the bleak industrial workers' paradise, which did so much to make one grateful for the West, where you could be theoretically left-wing without having to suffer for it. We rode past a series of ugly 1950s flats. At a distance, Hitler's bunker, and at the end of every street, always die Mauer, the wall. Safely back in West Berlin, we discovered that the Pembroke Players were in town, giving performances of Macbeth. We went along to say hello. Oddly, they had a telegram for me. In Berlin? It was from the Footlights, from Humphrey Barclay. Cambridge Circus was such a success in the West End that they weren't going to be able to make their Edinburgh Festival booking. So Humphrey wanted me to do it with him and Graham Garden. I was to report immediately to Cambridge for rehearsals. Chapter 4. Showbiz. Summer term in Cambridge. Always the best of times. The colleges were out and there were lots of girls about in their summer frocks. The exquisite couple, Geeta and Sunny Mater, he, later a distinguished publisher at Picador in London and Knopf in New York, and she, a respected author, held court in their superior digs, packed with books, while I lived in a tiny room above a smelly restaurant, as we rehearsed for 3 weeks in the Footlights Club. Edinburgh was a blast. We all dossed in a walk-up sixth-floor cold water flat, but finally this was showbiz. At the tender age of 20, I made my first television appearance on Scottish TV's Festival Special, with Humphrey Barclay, the director of Cambridge Circus, doing a John Cleese sketch, naturally. Footlights 63 was a sold-out smash, mainly because we had all the best sketches from the Footlights West End hit. Harold Hobson of the Sunday Times said, "They attract admiration as effortlessly as the sun attracts the flowers," which was nice of him because the next night we nearly killed him, as all the sets collapsed when the revolving stage utterly failed to revolve in the world premiere of Henry Miller's only play, Just Wild About Harry, directed by Stephen Frears. This legendary disaster had brought all the London critics up to Edinburgh. The Cambridge Amateur Dramatic Club had discovered that Henry Miller once wrote a play that had never been produced. Nothing would prevent them from giving a world premiere to this piece at the Edinburgh Festival. Being Cambridge, they had decided to turn an old Baptist church into a modern theatre, complete with a revolving stage. For 6 weeks, heavily bearded men sawed and hammered away, but by opening night it was clear that neither the theatre nor the stage was ready, and there was nothing to do but delay. Being Cambridge, they thought about that too. Holding a press conference, they said that the very minor changes demanded by the local watch committee, who censored plays and public performances in Scotland, were so egregious that they must first contact Henry Miller to see if he would even permit them. There was some delay in contacting Henry Miller in California. When he was finally reached, not only did he seem surprised anyone was putting on his play, but he had no objection to whatever they wanted to do with it. So that was all right. For Cambridge, a perfect storm in a teacup. They could go ahead. Headlines were written, tickets were sold, and the play would open on the morrow. Except it didn't. The first scene passed safely enough, as I, who had been co-opted into the play amongst the thespians, exchanged a few words with a specially engaged professional little person, while we pretended to paint an apartment in San Francisco. Okay, she was a female acting a male, but it's not that easy to find short people on short notice for amateur productions of unwanted Henry Miller plays. And Cambridge has always been notoriously gender lax, and a jolly good thing too. Still, so far so good, the audience applauded dutifully. But the theatrical dream ended the same time as the scene. The revolving stage refused to revolve. 20 minutes passed of pushing, shoving, heaving and cursing. No matter how many pushers and shovers and heavers and cursers, the stage stayed firmly locked in place. The actors in the next scene remained firmly off stage. Finally, with one last desperate heave, the revolving stage lurched. The heavy flats began to shake and then slowly collapsed into each other like a pile of dominoes. The theatre critics fled up the aisle for their lives, leaving poor Harold Hobson alone up front in his wheelchair. Henry Miller's only play was dead. That show lasted only one night, but our review was a different story. We were a big hit. We naturally checked out our rivals, the Oxford Review. Where we appeared bright and frothy on stage, they were cool and sardonic. They also had girls. Bastards. They did something called Rejects Night, where they took sketches that hadn't quite made it and tried them out on an audience after their main show. This meant we could go along after our own show, and it was here that I first met the lovely, funny Terry Jones. Dark-haired, deadpan, handsome, with the looks of the movie star Anthony Newley. He, too, brought a tremendous seriousness to everything he did, including singing a song which sounds like an early precursor of the Lumberjack song.
I was Miss World from 1907 to 24. I was Miss World, lovely Bella Moore.
Totally ignoring the transgender implications, it lamented the fact that sadly age meant
no one wants to see me anymore.
Next summer, Terry would go on to star in the West End in the Oxford Review Hang Down Your Head and Die, a bitter polemic against capital punishment. Oxford, as always, was far more serious about everything. A year later, in Edinburgh, in 1964, I met the unforgettable Michael Palin, who had joined Terry Jones in the Oxford cast. I first saw him on stage, and he bowled me over. He did an extended character monologue about an old northern performer who came on to begin his terrible act with an appalling song, only to notice that on stage beside him was a large gift-wrapped present. He tried to ignore it, but couldn't, and stopped his song to take a look at it. He read the label out loud. To Mikey, with love from the audience. He was overcome. Oh, every people, I'm touched. I'm speechless. This is so special for me. I thought perhaps my act was over and that people didn't care anymore, that somehow I was too old and nobody remembered me. But now this, from you, the audience. It means so much to me. Well, there's only one thing I can do to thank you, and that's to sing my song, When Love Breaks Your Heart in a Million Tiny Pieces. with tears in his eyes, barely able to restrain himself, he began to sing.
When love breaks your heart in a million tiny pieces...
Boom! The present exploded. The look on his face as he quietly limped off stage was brilliant. And that's Michael Palin, really. He writes real character sketches and acts them with genuine emotion. I became very aware of this writing talent of Michael's when I was adapting Spamalot for the stage from The Holy Grail. I love putting in Mike's writing because it was always character-driven.
What, ridden on a horse? You're using coconuts. One day, lad, all this will be yours.
What, the curtains?
Not the curtains, lad.
Albeit unknowingly, by September 1964, all the future Pythons, save for the wild-card American animator, had met and admired each other. Chapter 5, Gateshead Revisited. With no threatening finals, the second year of Cambridge was fun. After Edinburgh, we were the big stars of the footlights, and it was even profitable. Graham Garden and I drove round the country every weekend in our dinner jackets with David Goodison, a man who became famous for doing a one-man show where he outnumbered the audience, and Jim Beach as our pianist, playing cabaret at various hunt balls, May balls, debutantes balls, and upper-class social events. Usually performing two a week in, we pulled in 25 quid a week for four of us, three performers and a pianist. Decent money for those days. How do we know some people will recur throughout our lives? Jim was irresistible. Today he manages Monty Python and Queen. Jim led the band in our Edinburgh show Footlights 63 and then ran a Deb's Delight band called The Autocrats for many years, which included a peer of the realm on drums. I'd realised early in my first year that I didn't have to attend lectures. It was our opinions they wanted, and provided I read the books, I could supply plenty of them. So, unencumbered by hard work, my social life was glorious and involved fine sherry, pubs and punting and lots of vinous games of croquet. I used to refer to this life as Gateshead Revisited. Jim had a propensity for outrageous suits in bright orange and lime green, which he wore with floppy hats. I remember one spectacular night walking back from his college Queens to my digs near Pembroke with Jim wearing an outrageous lavender suit. We'd been drinking. Jim had climbed up and was precariously walking along the parapet of the Silver Street Bridge above the River Cam at about 4 in the morning.
"I want a fuck!"
he suddenly yelled at the top of his lungs. "Shh, Jim," I said, "it's late."
"You want a fuck too," he bellowed. "You're just quiet about it."
Then two events changed the world. John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, and the Beatles came through Cambridge. In America, a monochrome world of grief gradually slipped into outrage as Vietnam put its fatal grip on America. There were civil rights marches in Selma and Alabama. Back in the UK, the drab post-war era was passing. Black and white Britain suddenly turned into colour. We were no longer young undergraduates in Harris tweed jackets with elbow patches. We were part of a movement. The 60s. We bought black collarless Beatle jackets. We were first in line for their singles. We discussed our favourite Beatle. We adored A Hard Day's Night. Suddenly, England started to matter and swing a bit. That summer, my friend Carey Harrison, a tall, handsome fellow English student from Jesus College, what a friend we have in Jesus, we would say about him, introduced me to the joys of the French countryside when we took a train down to the Dordogne. We sat reading Dickens in the soft June sunshine, attended floodlit cycle races in the streets of a French village, and rode to the local fêtes in the ubiquitous De Chavaux. We even played cricket in the square at Montpazier. It was heaven. Carey, now an English lecturer, playwright and novelist, was a polymath. I watched him on the train home in one railway carriage carrying on four simultaneous conversations, with a Frenchwoman in French, an Italian businessman in Italian, a German traveller in German, and me in my demotic English. in his deeply rich Harrovian voice, not a million miles away from that of his matinee idol papa, Sexy Rexy. I had several older friends, too. I particularly like Aussies and Yanks, usually because they'd already done degrees, but also because they were funny. By the time he arrived on his Fulbright scholarship from Yale, my friend Stephen Greenblatt had already published a book, Three Modern Satirists, on War, Orwell and Huxley. Recently, when I interviewed him for Writer's Block Presents at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills about his book The Swerve, the medieval discovery of Lucretius's extraordinary poem On the Nature of Things, he said that he'd known me for many years, but for him, the greatest achievement of the evening was finally getting me into a synagogue. My friend Jim Beach became a lawyer at Harbottle and Lewis, and years later, when we won a lawsuit against ABC and the BBC in New York for airing butchered versions of Monty Python's Flying Circus without our approval, he advised us not to accept the £2 million on offer, but to ask instead for our masters. This brilliant piece of advice earned us everything, ownership and worldwide control over our TV series. It means that, including movies, Python now owns almost everything we ever made. We may be silly, but we're not stupid. In my final year at Cambridge, I became president of Footlights, appointed by the outgoing president, Graham Garden, and senior fellows. I got to wear a faded, tattered pink dinner jacket at smoking concerts, appoint my committee, organise our cabarets, and take care of business, ensuring the smooth running of the club. As if to prove you shouldn't allow lower-class boys into positions of power, I single-handedly altered the rules of this 1883 organisation to permit women to join as members, to the unhappiness of several older dons who thought I was ruining the club. I wrote a letter to Harry Porter, the senior treasurer, demanding women be admitted to full membership in the Footlights. I think it is degrading and fantastically backward-looking that women should not have the same opportunities at university as men, and it is rather sad that the Footlights lag even behind the union in this. I'm still proud of that. It would be several years before the colleges themselves followed suit. The very first woman admitted to the Footlights was Germaine Greer. It's odd that Germaine should have gone on to write The Female Eunuch, and she had the biggest balls of any woman I've ever known. She was hilarious. Her audition piece was a stripping nun that brought the house down. She'd come as a mature student from the University of Melbourne, where she told me she performed what she called virgin duty, sexually liberating first-year students. Soon after she left Cambridge, she would become the first lecturer at Warwick University to appear on the cover of Suck magazine. I adored her. She was with me in my final Footlights review, which toured the UK for a few weeks. She bet me she could sleep with every single member of our tour. I won. She got stuck on the horn player. Germaine had come through the Footlights door with Clive James, and we became friends. He introduced me to his poetry and Brett Whiteley drawings, and I observed his unceasing pursuit of the female. His father, too, had not returned from the war. I found I unconsciously bonded with several people like that, including Germaine and Harry Nielsen. Our puzzlingly titled and not particularly funny review, My Girl Herbert, limped into London and floundered after 3 weeks at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith. John Cameron, a leather-jacketed rocker who played crazy piano and sang like Ray Charles, joined me in a duo, and we were picked up as a musical cabaret act by the Noel Gay Organisation. They immediately booked us into the Blue Angel, a nightclub catering to guards officers, where we triumphed on opening night and then faded quickly throughout the week. Upper-class twits brayed drunkenly during our set while trying to paw their Kensington girlfriends. As we progressively died each night, John Cameron slid further and further behind his piano until he was finally totally hidden, and I was left alone on stage to face the hoorays. It was the end of our less-than-dynamic duo, and I went off to Leicester Rep to perform in a musical, Oh, What a Lovely War, directed by Richard Eyre, another contemporary. The Phoenix Theatre Leicester surprisingly asked me to stay on for their Christmas production, where I learned I was not cut out for acting. I just don't have the patience for it. Their holiday offering was a Ray Cooney farce about a butler called One